Hey Bill and Gunnar, welcome to Blackwall Tribal Edition. Murumu here with you today, and Gaiwaragalanundu, may God's peace be upon you wherever you are listening to this program. And we've got a bit of an international flavour to the program today, and joining me as usual is Gunyara, who acts as the Attorney General for the Sovereign Unity Government most times. And Gunyara, welcome to the show.
Yeah, another beautiful afternoon in paradise, eh?
It is. We're going to be looking at a... people might have heard of the United States state of Oklahoma. It is the... from what I've been looking at, home to five different tribal nations there. And there was a recent agreement done over there to do with jurisdictions and the federal court of the United States. Determined that there were these jurisdictions there still, and but the state of Oklahoma has come up with an agreement of some sort that's not legally binding, but allows that jurisdictional coexistence. Now, from your, we don't know too much about it, but it would be interesting to see how the Yidinji possible agreement with the Commonwealth of Australia would sort out some of these things, because in this particular agreement it says that if you're a Native American victim or a Native American offender, then there's the various crimes would say automatically shift you to either a federal jurisdiction, a state jurisdiction, or a tribal jurisdiction. And I think that would be very interesting to go through today.
Yeah, look, what's going on there is not the Yidinji way. That's one thing for sure there. We'll get that straight right from the start of this. The Indians, you know, as in this case, it was the Muscogee, I think it was, that got this going. Over there, it's a domestic form of sovereignty, where the US is the overarching, the big thing, the big boy in town, and it's once again what citizenship that these Native Indians hold, you know, what they're holding in their hand as to where they are. They have reservations there, just like in Australia, we have these, what everyone used to call a mission, you know, a designated area, and these people lived on that, you know, just they had bigger allocations over there for their territory. These were nutted out many years ago when the white fellows were moving in. But it is a domestic form of sovereignty where the US overall is responsible for so much, like criminal law, you know, protecting the US, the landmass itself, from invaders, the taxation, all that sort of jazz. And, you know, as in those Indian nations, they actually use the US dollar anyway. So the US are the printers of the currency that they use. So this is sort of limiting where they are. And that's what I'm saying. This is not the Yidinji way. It's not the way that we, in any way, shape or form, negotiate with Australia. So from our point of view, the sovereignty of the Aboriginal people must come back in its true and correct capacity as being the original sovereignty, the one that's still here. Remember, Uluru said sovereignty was never ceded. It's never been extinguished, and it's still here today, and that's where the ownership of the land is. So what's that of Australia? We don't know. You know, what's the sovereignty of Australia? It's just a bunch that have moved in here. Unlike the US, when the British went there, they actually negotiated a lot of treaties with the original tribes there. There was all sorts of treaties, including, you know, other contracts, logging arrangements, fishing arrangements. So this is where these reservations were drawn up back then in the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s. Reservations were made for these people to move on to if they give up some of their sovereignty, which they did cede away to someone. Now, is it that someone that they ceded sovereignty to, is it the modern United States? I've got to question that right there and then. If they're holding a US citizen, remember this was seen in the state court, you could say, the state of Oklahoma. So they could see this, and then it'd end up in the federal court system. So they could see who these people were. These were citizens of the US or of the Muscogee tribe, or what were they? See, I think they might have been US citizens or holders of US citizenship. So that's how they could end up in there. Unlike Australia, where if you hold tribal identity only, and it's been proven a number of times, and including here recently, you know, only 4 or 5 years ago, that if you're not one of theirs, if you're not one of the state, a citizen of Australia, they can't actually see you here. You know, if you're one of the original people whose sovereignty was before Australia, the Commonwealth of Australia can't legally see you. And this is the exact opposite over there. That's why I'm saying this is a form of domestic sovereignty, where the overall big power is the US. And then it brings about that question of what happens if, say, one of the Muscogee tribe injure or kill, you know, well, I say kill an American, a US citizen. In what jurisdiction do they end up then? And the way I sort of read through all this is they'll end up in the US jurisdiction, so where things such as capital punishment do apply. But do they really have consent to end up in there? You know, have they given consent to be proper, full-on American US citizens? And that's what I'm saying. I understand that some of those Indian nations are not agreeing to that agreement put forward by Oklahoma. So if it's a non-binding agreement, you know, in law, what's really the good of it? So these are the sort of questions you've got to ask about that. But it does raise, one thing it does do is raise the awareness of sovereignties that coexist, these jurisdictional issues. You know, in whose jurisdiction is the US? Is the US in the Muscogee jurisdiction or the other way around? You know, is the Muscogee inside the US jurisdiction? These have got to be addressed, and we don't want to go down that road here. We want to get it very clear from the start that we're here first and Australia is here second. And we'll work together. That's what a treaty does. We will cede some sovereignty, and that sovereignty may be international affairs. We will appoint the Commonwealth of Australia to go forward and do our bidding at the international level between the other UN member states, or, you know, between the states of Australia. So we've got to be very clear on this. But we're not going to cede sovereignty over our citizens. They're not going to go and leave. We're not going to give them over to Australia, so our law is you know, useless. We've got no citizens left. So let's get that right from the start.
Well, you mentioned that there's a few people that have backed away from that agreement already. I can see here from an article on a letter dated July 17th of this month, which is in 2020, the two chiefs of the Muscogee Creek Nation, David Hill, and the Seminole Nation Chief Greg Chilcote, said they weren't in support of the agreement, and this is why. And I'm quoting here from the letter. "I want to inform you that the Muscogee Creek Nation is not in agreement with the proposed agreement in principle document released yesterday by the state of Oklahoma. The nation, as in the Muscogee Creek Nation, will continue to pursue all appropriate intergovernmental agreements to ensure public safety within its borders, as intergovernmental agreements are the hallmark of respect among sovereigns. The Muscogee Creek Nation will oppose any proposed legislation that diminishes the nation's sovereignty." So you can see there that I think they can see it as clear as crystal that it is a bit of fluff in terms of non-binding agreements, and that possibly in their view, and I'm putting words in the mouth here, that the state of Oklahoma may be kicking the can down the road a little bit more.
Well, it could be trying to minimise the impact of what is really there. Now, the only thing I have to say, and that's what I'm saying about identities, is what identity was that bloke using? You know, you see the name you read out, Mr. Hill. Would that be a Muscogee citizen or a US citizen? And you remember, this is a man. We go back to the start of this. We're humans. We're just like animals, like kangaroos and bandicoots and possum. We walk around, we can do stuff, we live, we die, you know, we bleed. When, you know, you cut an animal, it bleeds. You cut us, we bleed. We're no different to these Sorry.
You just maintain that distance, will you?
Yeah, I'll just get rid of me corona out the way. Yeah, just got a bit of a dry throat. Sorry about that. But look, we're no different to animals. We are an animal, but the big thing we have is a brain that allows us to make man-made law. Man-made law is what we talk about here, Australia, US law, Muskogee law, Yidinji law, it's all the same. It's all man-made. But we have a choice. We have a choice to be in Australia, we have a choice to be in Yidinji, they have a choice to be in their Muskogee nation, or a choice to be a US citizen. Which one do they really want? Now, that name, I've got to ask, is in what jurisdiction was it created? Because that is where he's being seen legally and politically through.
Well, I don't know that, to be honest, but look, they might be using their sovereignty to create their own personality, talking through that there, and because of that historic agreement, treaty between the United States at the time and that particular nation, it could be, I just don't know, to be honest. But it would appear that if they're appearing inside the state, then it possibly could be something that is created and subject to the US Constitution or derivative of that. The state of Oklahoma, for example. I just don't know. But what is clear is that there are jurisdictional issues, and not just over there, here, or it's around the whole planet. And this is the thing now. The Yidinji government is here to protect the Yidinji citizen. And any formal agreement with the Commonwealth of Australia or any other UN member state for that matter, would maintain that jurisdiction. Now, like I said, the Uluru Statement talked about the coexisting sovereignties. Well, the coexisting sovereignty here, the number one sovereignty here on the Yidinji territory is the Yidinji Nation, belongs to it. So there is no way that the Yidinji government would allow a foreign entity to usurp the sovereignty that would endanger its own citizens. So that's the main thing that we're talking about, obviously, and that the Yidinji courts, which aren't too far away, by the way, we can talk about that a little bit later on too, Ganyara, about the processes involved with that, and that we have a tribal council a court system, but in terms of the part of a legislation of the actual court system, that's very close to coming to fruition there. But yeah, there must be a clear line in the sand as to what matters are Yidinji and staying Yidinji.
Well, with this here, and it's just over there with these people, they realise there's something going on, you know. But I got a feeling, just on the face of it, that they're just not aware of the capacity of their citizen. If they're being seen in Oklahoma, quite obviously, have they given up the sovereignty to go back to their original name, you know, their original tribal lot? We don't know. But on the face of it, they are appearing to be using, you know, a US name. You know, that's owned by the citizen, or the citizen's owned by the US. Well, that's fair enough. Look, everyone's got a choice to do that if they want. But when you talk about jurisdictional issues and sovereignty, you've got to be very aware of where the identity that you're using is created and where it's coming from, where it's going. When the magistrate pulled up our foreign minister, said, you know, when the police pulled him up and put him into the court, as the judge said there, which is rightly so, if you're not one of ours, you're free to go at large, which basically meant if you're not using our citizen, our person, you're not one of us. You can't be seen in our court. And remember, the court's not the big building. The court is a piece of paper. A court can be anywhere. Just like our courts, how they're created, just like Australia. Our courts are very separate from the political world. So, you know, there's this independent side arm of it all. So the courts actually interpret the legislation, basically.
Now, as the Attorney General, and I guess by default you have the hard task of putting together some of the things to do with jurisprudence and justice and things like that. We know that The Royal Court exists today. That is the Yidinji Tribal Council of Elders, or Janala Yidinji, can determine certain matters. But there is a wish to create a legal system to deal with the citizenry. And, you know, obviously we're still building that this world, and that's going great guns too. But there has to be a process that and explain that process to us, because I think a lot of people out there listening to that, even including those who are foreigners who work in the legal realm, would be interested to know how that's going to work, because I think they're just as excited as us about how the Yidinji Nation would allow, let's say, the Commonwealth to plug into the sovereignty here and allow some sort of interface into between the different legal systems and all that kind of stuff. So explain how the basic steps now that Yidinji are making to get into this, let's say, a federal court of some sort inside the Yidinji territory that is a Yidinji one.
Well, look, just remember this. There are two levels even inside Yidinji. There's this original tribal level where the old people actually do speak. They speak volumes. And they judge in a lot of matters, you know, where, say, you murdered someone. You're going to be taken before them people. You murdered one of the tribe, you're going to be taken before them. And they'll judge in the matter. And that normally, if you're guilty, ends in capital punishment. We can't go down that road at the next level down, which is the government level, which is the world of paper. So we've got to be very careful of which jurisdiction we're going to be in inside Yidinji. Is it going to be the tribal level or the paper level? You know, just like Australia. So bearing in mind that those two are there, those two jurisdictions exist. One is God's things and one is paper things. So we're building the world of paper now. This whole world of real stuff exists. It always has, always will. But we're going back to the world of paper now. And this is where we want to form this legal system, this legal arrangement. And remember, I always keep saying this, it's got to be independent of any of your political or bureaucratic side that you're making in the world of paper. So governments make law and the court interprets it, you know. Mm. So the law is made by the will of the people of that society. So say it's about, let's say a speeding car. The speed limit is 60 k's an hour. The politicians have worked it out, passed legislation, it's got through, and now you're pulled up by the police, the Yidinji police, doing 70 or 65 or whatever. So the court, now they just say, tell it to the judge. If you want to argue the case, tell it to the judge. If you don't think that law applies to you, tell it to the judge. Mm. And they go and determine which one it is. But the judge can't be influenced by the political system. He has to read the paper and read it straight down the line for what it is. There is no, the Prime Minister said or the Chief Minister said this to me that we can fudge it a bit. No, it's separated. Must be completely separated. But we're trying to build this as a next level above the High Court of Australia, because once we start talking about treaties, how are the two things going to interact when things like jurisdiction are called to account, when I'm tribal all of a sudden, or I'm Yidinji all of a sudden, or I'm Australian all of a sudden. So say I'm a holder of Yidinji citizenship, of a tribal citizenship, and we have a treaty with Australia. What happens if I break the Queensland speed limit, or which is identical or different to the Yidinji speed limit? So what happens in that instance, and in what jurisdiction are you going to be heard? But we want to go to the next level where we see this all the time, and this is where sovereignty is coming a bit unstuck. I'm tribal, I hear it all the time, and I've seen cases about this where people holding Australian citizenship said, no, I'm tribal, we're not subject to Australian law. And the judge immediately can see this straight away. They're in the court through the Australian citizen. You know, so he's saying, look, you're a bit of a clown, just shut up, and you're one of ours. What happens when you pull out your Yidinji citizenship and say, well, look, here I really am, or your tribal citizenship, here I really am. Mm. And
let's put all the cards on the table. This is the Yidinji one, for example. That's where it comes into, like, it is just a piece of paper, but in that world of paper, it is a very, very powerful piece of paper, and one that that I dare say the Australian judiciary would be very, very cautious to interfere with at this stage.
Well, most definitely. They actually can't, without a treaty, they can't interfere. Tribal stuff is tribal stuff. Remember, these sovereignties coexist and there's no treaty yet. So we've ceded nothing, nothing's been extinguished. We're just always here. And Australia is just the intruder, they're the trespasser in here. We're trying to welcome them into our house through a treaty, properly. And this, as you said, this is about protecting the sovereignty of the tribal people here. Yeah, it really is, but it's also trying to help the Commonwealth of Australia get some validity at law to validate its foundational document, its constitution. Where's it going to be? But in saying all of that, let's go back and have a look at another issue, like environmental issues. The Australians want to build, let's say, a bigger Navy base in the city of Cairns, which we call Gimoi. There's no treaty yet between us to let that happen. But say there was one. Now, there is a treaty, and all the local Australian citizens don't want a big Navy base. And they take it right to the High Court of Australia, and all of a sudden it's lost. No, we're going to have to build our Navy base. This is our right to do it. You can't stop it. There's one more court of appeal, and that is the Yidinji Court, that they can go to above the, anything that Australia produce. And they can come to there through a treaty, through the treaty with Australia, that we don't want this Navy base, and they put their case forward to the Yidinji equivalent to the High Court. And are we going to ask the elders? Remember, under UNDRIP, the UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, the state must consult and cooperate with the Indigenous peoples concerning things like the environment. Now, our elders can sit down and determine what they believe is right or wrong. Then they can inform the Yidinji government its thoughts. Yidinji can then weigh up, the Yidinji government can weigh up the pros and cons from both sides of the matter, and then make a decision. But this court of appeal, that is the Yidinji court, would be well versed on both sides of what is going on. Even though it's independent of the Yidinji political system, it does have to understand what is going on by the Yidinji elders, what they mean.
You're listening to Blackhawk Tribal Edition right across the planet today, thanks to the Yidinji Broadcast Service. And if you're listening inside of Australia, it's probably via the National Indigenous Radio Service. We'll be back after the break.
He said to me, hey, little black girl, won't you come away with me?
Girl, won't you open up your eyes?
Hey, welcome back to the program. Ganyara, we're talking about the Yidinji legal realm and the lawful realm, and you were explaining the court system there of the equivalent of a Yidinji High Court and I guess a Privy Council in terms of the other space, the two levels we're talking about there. I think it's a very important thing to not only ensure the longevity of the Australian citizen, but obviously the Yidinji one too, and all the other citizens that may come here, all those pieces of paper from France, Germany, Namibia, wherever, you know what I mean?
It sure is. Now, look, let's go in reverse to that. You know, the Australians want to put a Navy base up. Now, let's go in reverse to that. You know, we'll use Fukushima as a good example. Now, it's pouring radioactive water out, you know. It's a sad case. It's an accident. You know, the Japanese didn't intentionally do that, but that's an accident that's happened. And say it's the radioactivity is streaming down through the Pacific and it's affecting the Yidinji people here off our country. You know, they're going out fishing and become radioactive, whatever it is. They're eating radioactive fish, whatever the case may be. Where do we, you know, we can determine in our court that, yeah, that we are being harmed and affected. You know, the Yidinji citizen can bring a case to the court to have it heard. And the court can say, yep, it is radioactivity. It's come from Fukushima. All the evidence is pointing to there. How do we then instruct Australia to go forward and do our bidding overseas to tell Japan, look, geez, your stuff is coming down here and it's poisoning our people? So you see, this is in reverse now. So our court can make a determination or a decision to tell the Commonwealth of Australia to go out on behalf of the Yidinji people to stop that radioactive water coming down here, you know, wherever it may be. That's just an example. So we've got to work this in reverse. It works both ways, you know. It's a two-way street. So we're building this for Australia. We're building it for Yidinji. But this is just, we're getting there. And it is taking time. There's a lot of legwork involved in this. It's not just let's just draw a piece of paper up. You know, we've got to sort of stick with the protocols of the modern world. And, and that's why we won't go down the domestic sovereignty road that a lot of the US has done with the Indian nations over there.
Well, not only that, here too. And look, it's a choice. And we're talking about this because I think all the other discussions around sovereignty, a majority of them are what we would describe as political sovereignty, sovereignty within Australia. And Brother Michael Menzel talks about the seven state within Australia. Victorian treaty model, the South Australian one, the Northern Territory one. They're all, in our opinion, matters that are best dealt with inside the Commonwealth, and we don't disagree with that. But in saying that, one must really comprehend the situation that perhaps the tribes we know that the tribe here is the only one that can grant the Commonwealth and look after it, entry into the Yidinji territory to look after the Commonwealth. And if that's the remedy, then what are people doing inside of Australia to fix that? I would say that their parameters are very, very limited inside the Commonwealth, because you got to go back to the original boss, in this case Yidinji here, and you know the Yidinji territory is only boss for the Yidinji mob. It's not boss for the Kukuyalanji and Arunda or whoever else it is. They got their own sovereignty and their own nationality and their identities. However, we would welcome them with open arms, obviously. One being a neighbour, one being very, very far from here, the Umbunta or Alice Springs area. But like I say, this is about protecting everybody and really going back to the original, having a house party and inviting people in and letting them go and, you know, and being very amicable about it, but at the same time being serious in trade, but also being swift to act on justice matters and matters of law, because that's, you know, if we let things get out of control, they grow into bigger problems, and the Yidinji Nation has said, okay, it's time to step up to the plate and do this now, because this child called the Commonwealth is walking around on our territory knocking stuff over, and it's hurting people, and we need to sort of correct it.
We sure do, but how do you do that if you're not in the correct capacity and standing? There was actually an interesting court case inside Queensland, the Supreme Court, only a couple of years ago, where an Aboriginal lot decided, you know, that they shouldn't be paying rates, you know, against one of the councils.
Is this the Boulogne Shire or something like that? I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, the Boulogne Shire. They took on the Boulogne Shire Council. And look, in there, there's a good determination, a good decision in there when you read that. The judge actually says, you know, so much for your sovereignty. We're discussing the issue of sovereignty, you know. And the judge says, so much for your sovereignty. You know, you come into my court claiming that you are sovereign, that you have this sovereign ability, this power. Well, the sovereign power and ability means you've got the right to create your own court. And the judge goes on a bit further, you know, that it's not so much how much sovereignty the state is going to give to you, but how far you're going to take sovereignty, how much reach you're going to take for sovereignty. So it's not up for the government to give you anything. It's up for you to take whatever you think is yours. And if you own the place, as native title says, you own the place, pursuant to your laws, you own the place, take the lot. It's your stuff to take. And that's why I'm saying this is the basis of Yidinji. We know we're the owners, always have been. Yidinji have always owned this place and they've given nothing away at this stage. So if we're going to be that, let's start acting it.
Yeah, you said it there, the actor. You know, be the main actor. Don't be the what do they call them things in the background? There's a minor role and people in the background, but I can't remember the name of it, to be honest, off the top of my head. But the extras, that's what they are, the extra. You can talk all you want that this is your... you got an idea for a movie and you want to write the script, but you keep acting in other people's movies because you haven't got around to writing your own script yet, you know, and this is what it's all about. This is getting on the piece of paper and writing your feature film, and you get to say what is said on that piece of paper. You get to say who acts in that world or that movie, and what happens in that movie, who's the hero and what's not, and how this all works. You see, this is what it's all about, and which is quite funny about this, you know, it's a masquerade. That's what reminds me of these COVID masks. It's a masquerading, you know, like people are acting as well. And I'm not taking away the seriousness of the health attached to that, but that's what it reminds me of, a masquerade, the ones in Italy and in Greece and things like that. But they're quite interesting when you look at a personality. Right? You can act happy or sad and wear this sad mask or a happy mask. You can wear an Australian mask. You can wear a Yidinji mask. You can wear a Cherokee mask, or you know, all these things. But how many masks are made in China? You know, this one's made in Ghimoy. This Yidinji mask is Yidinji 100%.
And that's what I'm saying about the Muskogee lot. How are they being seen? As I look at that name written down there, I sort of got a feeling that it's through the US identity. So we're talking about the Muskogee, them and the, like the Cherokee them. How far are they going to reach with their sovereignty? Now, that's what they've got to do. They've got to understand this stuff. Yeah, we'll create our own stuff. We can. We can legally do that. The UN have recognised, and all the UN member states have recognised, that the Indigenous nations can do this under Article 3, 4 and 5 under it.
And that was I was going to prompt you with this one, Gunyar, is that treaty is excellent evidence that the Muskogee, in their true and correct capacity, is the boss, that they had the ability to go forth and conduct this agreement or offer the agreement to the US and negotiate whatever in the best interest of their nation. Somewhere down the track here, being in 2020 now, why is the need to negotiate? Something must have happened along the way, and we can only guess that the the native men and women are now using America's personalities and possibly inside of that state of Oklahoma, addressing the matter of sovereignty when there's already a realm back and historic evidence saying, well, go and do it, but create your own person, write your own movie. You got your own studio. Why are you coming to Hollywood for?
Doesn't that remind you of New Zealand, of the land of the long, long white cloud? Now, New Zealand had, in 2015, they commissioned a study into the Treaty of Waitangi. Now, they come back and said, yeah, the Treaty of Waitangi is for real. It's legit. It's a legit document. Now, the Treaty of Waitangi is between the original inhabitants down there, Tangata Whenua, if you want to call them that, or, yeah, most people know them as Maoris, but that's not the real way of putting it. But it's between the original inhabitants and the British. There's two parties involved. Who is New Zealand? Who are the New Zealanders? Because they're not British, and they're not the original inhabitants, the Tangata Whenua or the Maori. They're neither of those. So who is New Zealand? So are those original inhabitants being seen legally and politically through their citizen, through the British citizen, or through the New Zealand citizen? And that's how you get lost in jurisdictions. Remember, we're talking now, there's three jurisdictions involved in this one very case of Treaty Waitangi. Is it the same over there in the US? Remember, we had conversation only, would have been October, November last year, with the Indian groups of what you want to call Canada. And it dawned upon one of them then that this was the mistake they were making. The fundamental mistake was they were being seen legally and politically through the Canadian citizen. And it dawned upon them that that's where they'd walked away from their law and joined to Canadian law. So you see what I'm saying? This is the same in this Muskogee lot. Have they joined up to the US? Have they mobbed down in the land of the long white cloud? Have they joined up to the New Zealand lot? What about here in Australia? I would say nearly everyone here in Australia, the Indigenous people, have been seen legally and politically through the Australian identity only.
Yes, and that's when they're conducting their own businesses, and when a police officer asks you for your name, date of birth, and shows some ID, that's when that jurisdiction appears to come alive. You're listening to Blacklaw Tribal Edition right across the planet today, thanks to the Yidinji Broadcast Service. And if you're listening inside of Australia, it's probably via the National Indigenous Radio Service. We'll be back after the break.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the program. Colonialism and the symptoms of colonialism are very much evident today. If you look around the world, there are many people that have been displaced, and as a result of genocide, there appears to be a lot of confusion and whatnot, and a lot of hurt. One of the stories that we did report on Black Law Tribal Edition was that of King Leopold of Belgium. We know that in the Congo, or the area described in the African continent as the Congo during King Leopold's reign, more than 10 million or around 10 million people were killed as a result of his actions under his administration. So there's been a lot of, in recent times, a lot of action inside of Belgium, people painting and taking down the statues of King Leopold. And so it's a very interesting turn of events. Recently also, in what's described as Western Australia, there was a region of a group of mountains or hills described, named after King Leopold. That was recently overturned, and the tribal name has replaced that now. But we're going to listen to an interview conducted by democracy.org, this is via YouTube, with Prince Esmeralda of Belgium, and she's talking about, her family's actions, and let's take a listen to that, her interview now.
Princess Esmeralda, I want to ask you about the Belgian government's response so far to this history between Belgium and colonial Belgium and Congo. In recent years, the Belgian government has issued apologies for some aspects of its relationship to Congo, including the separation of mixed-race children from their Congolese mothers, as well as for Belgium's role in the assassination of Congo's first post-colonial prime minister, Patrice Lumumba. Even though many, including the UN, have called for Belgium to apologize for its brutal rule, King Philippe, in the letter that we mentioned earlier, and he sent to the DRC president, he only expressed the deepest regret for what Belgium had done, acts of violence and cruelty, as he said. Now, many have said that that letter, quite apart from not containing an apology, is almost entirely irrelevant because the king does not represent the viewpoint of the Belgian government since he's not formally a member. And then the question of why it is that Belgium has apologized for certain aspects of its rule, but not for its overall brutality in the region. So could you talk about that and whether you think these protests might produce an apology now?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there was also always some mixed message. There were some apologies for some things, but there were other people, other ministers saying, no, we should not apologize. We cannot erase history. So I think, honestly, this first step by the king saying that he expressed deep regrets obviously doesn't go far enough, but it's a first step. It's quite historical in our country that a chief of state recognizes, acknowledges the problem of the past. Obviously, we have to go much further, and the parliament has voted for a commission of truth and reconciliation. And I really hope that this will expose the past honestly, get rid of a narrative that was built over the years with a certain nostalgia by some of Belgium ex-colonizers saying, but there were good things in the colony. No, they were not. It was a brutal system which provoked a crime. It was exploitation of the people. And not only the crimes and the rapes and the most atrocious human rights violation happened, but also it had an impact on the country culturally and deep impact in the society that is still today. And of course, we have to realize that racism in our country, like in many countries of Europe, are essentially from colonialism and slavery. And Belgium is not alone. I'm aware that there are petitions that are starting to be organized for other European countries to recognize, acknowledge their past.
I wanted to ask you, one of the demands that protesters are making is to transform the curricula of Belgian schools so this colonial history is taught more accurately. For decades, Belgian children were taught that Leopold II, in fact, brought civilization to the areas of Central Africa that he governed, abolishing slavery, building roads and schools, introducing democracy to Congo. Now the education minister for French language schools has said educators would require the teaching of Congolese history and Belgian colonialism. Could you talk about that? What needs to be taught in Belgian schools?
I think it's a first step for a memorial reparation. We are not talking about amnesty of amnesia. We are not here to restore, you know, the colonial personality's honor. But even if we are forgiving and we are doing great steps to include in schools, you know, the colonial past of Belgium, we can't forget, for example, that the Congolese lands were plundered in the name of apparently legal texts, which only recognize, you know, the right of the strongest. We can't forget that there was apartheid under the, you know, colonial past under the Belgian Congo and under the Free State of Congo, and that black persons were not allowed to go to cinemas, restaurants, or so-called European shops. And it's that kind of, you know, historical facts, historical denial, historical crime that we have to share in the public space. And I think that this commission, that Parliament will allow and implement from September, the truth, reconciliation, and I would add reparation, it means material and memorial, will really create like a collective therapy for all the Belgians, including the post-colonial bodies like Congolese, Burundis, and Rwandese. I think it's a kind of a share collective memory. I'm, you know, that kind of irreversible food of this shared, you know, history. And the fact that even at university, when you are studying journalism, you don't cope with the real facts of the history of Belgium. When at schools, you are not including in the manuals the real colonial past of Belgium, coming from King Leopold II in 1885 till 1960s, when the independence of Congo was there. You know, it's important for affirmation and to include all the Belgian citizenships in the more serene atmosphere. No, Belgium won't escape that kind of therapy and work, you know, on his colonial past. It's really important.
Princess Esmeralda, I'm wondering if you can talk about the historic silence of your family, of the royal family, and the journey that you took, how you came to understand Leopold's history. You are the aunt of the current king. Your father was king. And of course, you're the great-grandniece of Leopold II, who we're talking about today. Give us a history lesson on what you understand he did.
Well, obviously, because I'm part of this family, I feel the responsibility to talk. I mean, my family has not talked before. I was one advocating always to talk about it, and recently to really apologize for this past, because I strongly believe that only with apologies first, we can build something different. We confront our past, and then we can build new relationship. My personal path, I have been an activist for the environment and for human rights for a long time, and I can see so much the link between racism, even in the climate crisis now, even in the way the indigenous people are displaced by all the multinational, the same way the colonizer moved and killed the indigenous people before. So all that for me makes so much sense. And I think we have to talk about that. It's a difficult conversation for many, especially when we talk about reparation, but it is absolutely necessary if we want to have a just, fair society. So if we talk about reparation, well, why not start by fair trade? That seems to be obvious. There are so many things we can do and try to have a better society where community can talk and flourish and where we don't have those discrimination that we see every day.
Princess Esmeralda, as you've mentioned, you mentioned and Gia mentioned earlier as well, the question of reparations. One of the striking things is that Congo is an extremely resource-rich country, but is also one of the poorest countries in the world. You mentioned now the issue of fair trade. Could you talk about the enduring legacy, the ways in which Congo continues to suffer from this legacy, and in addition to fair trade and reparations, what you think needs to happen?
Well, yes, that's really the doom of the country. The country is so rich in resources, in all the minerals, and unfortunately, the population is still not benefiting from that, because you still have a lot of multinationals which are plundering the country. And that's obviously a legacy from the past and from the colonial state before.
That brings it into a program today. Thank you, Ganyara, for coming down. We'll catch you next week, eh?
Thanks, Zach. All right.
May God's peace be upon you through his only begotten son, Yeshua HaMashiach, wherever you are listening to this program. We'll catch you next week. Okay, go.